My assigned topic was to talk about Jesus and his walk. And there's a real parallel. The pictures I was envisioning of our Lord's walk were not downtown Chicago pictures in my mind. They were not downtown New York. They were a little bit more like this. But there was one thing in all the descriptions I've heard over the years of this gathering that was not emphasized enough. And I'm here to tell you that that one thing was the love that is here. We've been just overwhelmed by the love expressed and shared here. And I never got enough of that when I heard the descriptions of this convention. So thank you. Thank you for having us, inviting us. And I'm Dawn, speaking for Dawn and myself. And thank you for being here. And let's get to work. You know, I'm a novice at these PowerPoint things. So my PowerPoint is nothing special. I'm not showing you engineering drawings and I have to point to them and say, well, this follows this. It's just a list of the words I was going to say anyway. But the assigned topic was describing Jesus' walk. And how did Jesus walk his walk and the walk? How are we doing? Okay, well, I'm fine. I'm going to start. And if the PowerPoint ever catches up, so be it. So a walk, walk the walk, walk the talk, talk the walk, walk the talk. One of the things that's kind of fascinating about these words in English is that they rhyme. That's kind of why it works for us. And when things rhyme, they're fun. And they're also effective in our memory. We can remember these little phrases like walk the walk. You know, it says paragraphs. It says books full. All I have to do is say that little phrase, walk the walk. The second thing that's interesting I find about this phrase and these words is that walk and talk are two of the very first functions that you are taught as a human being. When you are an absolute infant, one of the first motivations of your parents is to teach you to walk and to talk. They spend a lot of thought and energy. How are we going to get Junior to walk? How are we going to get Junior to talk? And of course, I have a friend that says, yeah. And as soon as you learn how to walk, they tell you to go sit down and stop walking all over the place. And as soon as you learn to talk, they tell you, now would you be quiet? So walk and talk are there first of all, and then right away they're trying to control us. Well, that's called life. Now, the next thing that's interesting about walk and talk is that how profound they can be, how deep. I want to say at a psychological level, at a meaning level, and when we discuss walk and talk, we're talking about our self-worth. Walking has come to represent what we do, and talking has come to represent what we say and what we profess. And the reason that this is so important and why these words mean so much is that we're talking about authenticity, what is real. And, you know, authenticity is everything. Why do we communicate? Why do we work? Is this authentic? Is this true? And if they're close together, there's a synchronization. There's a meshing. If walk and talk are together, oh, it just flows together. And if walk and talk are greatly separated, disharmony, dysfunction, out of tune. Very early on, as our parents are teaching us to walk and talk, we learn the technique of exaggeration. And, Mama, Mama, there's a big animal in the backyard. Johnny, that's called a squirrel. And, you know, why do we learn to exaggerate? Well, it gets attention. We can embellish things. We can make things bigger than life. And so it's just about inherent that we exaggerate. If we want to get a job, we exaggerate a little bit, our skills. If we want to get a wife, we exaggerate a little bit. So it maybe works the other way too. I don't know. Husband, anyway, okay. So, it's kind of ends up as Are you believable? Is what you're saying really who you are? And I think it's actually an element of the universe. Our God. Does our God do what He says He's going to do? That's our faith. That's our belief. We believe that God is going to do what He says He's going to do. And I think every part of His universe, if the walking is not close to the talking, there's a dysfunction. And our world at this time is absolutely filled, overwhelmed with dysfunction. I thought of an illustration. It has to do with airplanes. It has to do... my illustration was about movies. I don't know much about movies, but I've experienced this on a small scale, so I'm going to exaggerate it. Let's say the movie that we're watching is Gone with the Wind. Okay? Can you picture it? There's the lady with the big gown. There's the big antebellum house with the pillars out in front. I can just picture it. So I'm watching that picture, and the soundtrack is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. What's going to happen here? I'm watching one thing. I'm hearing another story. Is this going to work? Sometimes when we see a newscast, and I think you particularly see it when they say, we're now going to switch to our remote reporter at the scene of the crash. And there's a guy talking, and you can see his lips moving, and the sound is about a second or two off. The talk is not going with the walk. And if you watch it enough, it kind of makes you nauseous. And that's my theory about the universe and about us and about our life. If our walk doesn't equal the talk, there's going to be some nausea involved. In the Old Testament, when the Israelites came out of Egypt, you know, they were slaves. They didn't know a lot. They didn't have to know what to do next. They were told. So when they came out and they had freedom, they didn't know what to do. So Moses had to give them a set of rules. And he came back and he said, these are the rules. What did they say? It starts with the word all. All these things we will do. Now, was that walk or was that talk? That was talk. How did the walk go? Not so good. How long did Jehovah give them for their walk? 40 years. They still didn't make it. They couldn't get the walk even close to the talk. I want to tell you a story. True story, Bible student story. I heard it first when I was about 10 or 12 years old. So that means it's an old story. Okay, there was a Bible student, a brother, who at work had a somewhat, for him, unusual opportunity to talk to a fellow worker about his church and his religion. And so this brother told his friend about the Bible students. And he said, I wasn't there, but this is the story he testified about later. He said, the Bible students are different. The implication was better. And he said, we study the scriptures. We're not like other churches who don't know what the scriptures say. We know the scriptures. We know this. And because of that, we're actually different. Implication, we're better. We've probably all been guilty of a little bit of that. And his fellow worker paused for a moment, and then he looked at him, and he said, you know, you are no different than anybody else in this company. The brother was stunned. And then his friend continued. He said, I have only known one person in my life that I felt behaved like a Christian, and I could see it in his behavior. He said, of course you wouldn't know him, but his name... He says, I remember this guy. His name was XYZ. Well, guess what happened next? XYZ was a brother in the same ecclesia as our friend that I was telling you about. So here was one trying to talk the walk, and it didn't work. He got called on it. But there was another brother who was walking the walk. I don't think that we could have any better example of the walk than our Lord Jesus. And how can we learn more about His walk? Well, we have some good tools. One of them would be the Scriptures. And we all love what's called the red letter edition. And we know that there are certain editions of the Bible that the printers have put, when Jesus speaks, they put it in red. And for years, I have focused on those red
red words, the red letters. And I will open up my Bible and I'll read the red letters and then I'll skip over to the next red section. And I just want to absorb Jesus' words. Well, then I get an assignment for a convention in the Midwest called the Harvest Convention. And it says, present something on walking the walk. So I have to go to all the black letters. So I read through and I skip the red because I have read them before. And I look at all the black letters. So thank you so much for that assignment. How did you know I needed that? So as I was thinking about how people became acquainted with Jesus, I thought, you know, it didn't happen that all of a sudden your friend told you about Jesus and you were immediately ushered up and you met, here's Jesus. Hi, how are you? I don't think it happened that way. Not in most cases. So I tried to picture in my mind the progression. How's this going to happen? Well, I think for me it would have happened something like this. Your friend tells you about Jesus. Jesus is over there somewhere. He says, come on, let's go see Jesus. He's down by the river. So we start to go there. And what's the first thing that you see? You see a crowd of people. I mean, not a crowd like this. A crowd of hundreds, on some days, thousands of people. You know, you're not going to instantaneously get up and even to hear Jesus. You're going to see this from a distance. Matthew, the 4th chapter, it says, great crowds followed him from Galilee, Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. You know what that means? Great crowds followed him from all these places. That's everywhere. He just described north, east, south, and west. Great crowds. Not talking about, you know, in my mind, I'm picturing Jesus talking with his 12. Maybe there's another extra group there. I'm always thinking this small scene. I don't think that anymore at all. I think it was huge. Matthew 8, when he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. Matthew 13, and great crowds gathered about him so that he got into a boat and they pulled aside and the whole crowd stood on the beach. Do you get the picture? Thousands of people some days. Now when they dealt with Jesus, and we know what's going to happen next, right? It's all the healing things and Jesus touching them. And do you think these people formed a nice, neat line? Say, oh, no, you go ahead before me. I don't think so. These people are from the Middle East. They have a reputation for being a little bit aggressive. There were no lines. There were thousands of people surrounding this. I'm thinking, this is pretty close to chaos. The accounts say that some days there were 5,000 people, 7,000 people. Matthew says, hey, the numbers are 5,000 people plus women and children. Well, do you think they came with just one kid or so? No, there could have been families of 3, 4, 5 for every man. Do you realize what those numbers are? There could have been 15,000 people. There could have been 25,000 people around this. And you're coming up on the edge and you're trying to find out who this Jesus is. These are mob scenes. You think it was quiet? You think it was like this convention where they have chairs set out and everybody's nice and ordered? The chairman claps his hands, everybody comes and is quiet? Not for a moment. Not only was it a crowd, but you start to look around the crowd. Oh my gosh, what a mix of people. We've got old, we've got young, we've got some that look kind of well-to-do. We got people in rags. And you know what? There's some people here already that kind of look immoral. Look how that woman's dressed. Look at that. Look at that makeup. Look at that jewelry. You know, she looks like a prostitute. She's in the crowd. And she's not alone. There's a whole bunch of them. And oh my gosh. There were days when there actually were Samaritans in the group. Oh, I shudder to even say the word. And then when we got close enough to hear what Jesus was saying, you know, there was some confrontation going on. Those scribes and Pharisees came, and they were pointing fingers at him, and there was a little bit of voices being raised, and he was breaking traditions on Sundays and on the Sabbath. This is anything but a idyllic situation where there's a professor up front teaching a group of quiet students who are taking notes. This is what's going on. And you know what? There were days when Jesus disappeared. He wasn't even there. Where was he? Where did he go? He was here last night, and now he's gone. Oh, they say he goes up into the mountain at night, and he prays. Wow, that's interesting. So how are we going to sort this out? You know, we live today. We're used to organized things. We're used to chairs in a row. We're used to hearing news broadcasts where the reporter tells us things in order. We're kind of used to things being organized for us. So I tried to do that. As I read through all the black letters in the Gospels, I kind of focused a lot in Matthew and Mark. I was looking for things that were repeatedly happen. What were the things of the walk that looked like it happened every time they talked about it? Or traits that seemed to permeate everything. And I came up with eight. And these are only suggestions. Here's what I'd really like to happen. What I'd like to happen is that I'm telling you these things, and I kind of get your interest, and you go home, and you do this same process. You go through the black letters, and you kind of make categories. You say, well, I see a lot of this, and then on the next column, I say, okay, I'm going to do this. So that's what I'm hoping you do. I'm going to tell you my eight. Okay? Eight ideas, eight categories, eight concepts that I see in Jesus' walk. The first thing that I noticed, and this came from the crowd view, is that there's no discrimination in this man. Absolutely no discrimination. It's such a mixed group of people, but he doesn't seem to shun anyone. This is obvious. I could see this from a distance. There's outcasts there. There's sick people. There's well people. Some are well dressed. Rags. There's immoral people. There's Jews. He deals with non-Jews. He even deals with women. And let's face it, in that society, you better believe that that was not so usual. He talks to the women. He heals the women. He touches women. They touch him. And when we get closer to him, we see that there's no moral judgments. If someone says, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, he embraces them. There's no such concept as, you are not welcome here. Very open, embracing. At the same time, we see that he had some favorites. Because he was open to everyone and non-discriminating did not mean that his best friends weren't Peter, James, and John. He had three best friends. So put that into your computer. Open to everyone, and you can still have best friends. We'll talk about that some more. How did he achieve that? That's called balance. That's what we'll talk about later. The next thing you can't help but see is that he's totally into service. He is doing things for people all the time. And he said, recorded in Matthew, the 20th chapter, verse 28, an astounding statement. This is coming from the Son of God. This is coming from the Logos, who had a pre-human existence. And he says, I came here to the earth not to be served, but to serve. Is that an incredible statement? I think so. This man, this perfect man, head and shoulders in every respect above everyone else there, and he said, I have come to serve. Wow. His service knew no bounds. He just didn't take the easy ones. And if you can imagine, well, I've got to read some more. I've got to read you a scripture. Where are my scriptures? Okay. Anyway, service, healing. The thousands of people that came to him wanted to be healed. It says they brought the lame. They brought those who couldn't speak, who couldn't hear, the blind, crippled, skin diseases. They brought them all. And one of the other most astounding scriptures that we have of his record is that he touched people with skin diseases. He touched lepers. Against the law, he touched them. Do you realize what that meant to that person? This person with a skin disease. And in those days, if you had a disease, that was punishment from God. Okay, so you were outcast on all kinds of levels. And you were told to stay away because you were a leper. You had to tell people, I'm a leper, stay away from me. And what is Jesus? Do you realize that this person hadn't been touched since they were an infant, probably? They hadn't been touched. They didn't know what it meant for someone to grab hold of your muscle and your arm and squeeze it a little bit. And Jesus touches these people. It's one of the first things recorded, fourth chapter of Luke. I have come to the conclusion, after this study, that the vast majority of our Master's time was spent in healing and in service. I kind of used to think that He was always teaching. Well, He was. He was nonstop teaching. Between every event, He was teaching. But the longest recorded discourse of His is probably the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, 7. And you know how long that sermon would have taken to give if you just read it? It's a 15-minute sermon. It's a TED Talk. That's the longest one. The rest of His time, besieged by these thousands of people who wanted help, who wanted the kingdom. I come to the conclusion that was the biggest segment of His life. He fed people. He comforted people. Next comes humility. This is not an action. This is not an event. This is like an attitude. This is a style. Everything He did had this incredibly humble attitude. You know, when going back to our birth, when we're born, we have this innate desire. We want to be loved. We want to be liked when we grow up. We want to be liked. We want everybody to like us. We do all kinds of things to get people to like us. We want credit. Jesus was the total opposite. He didn't want any credit for anything He did. Touch the leper, heals the leper, and He says to the leper, "Don't tell anybody." That's amazing. You know, I do a little thing and I want to make sure everybody knows. But Jesus said, "Don't do your good works in front of other people. Don't! Don't let them know. Don't do your giving in front of people that they can see that. Don't do that. Don't even pray in public to be thought that I'm a good person. Look at me. I'm going to say a little word of prayer here." No, don't do that. This style, this, it permeated everything. And here's something that I didn't see before as far as His humility. He shared what He had. What do I mean? His abilities. Jesus was the greatest healer ever to come on the face of this earth. He could heal blind people. He could heal deaf people. He could heal crippled people. He could cast out demons. He could deal with psychological issues. He could handle all those things. And you know what He did with that skill? He gave it to the 12 that were His closest, and He gave most of it to the 72 that He sent out. Matthew 10, He says, "Go out and tell everybody that the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Verse 8, here's what to do. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, cast out the demons, raise the dead. I never saw that before. He said to His 12, "You can go out and raise the dead?" This is the Logos speaking. You think that He's going to keep that skill to Himself? To me, this is ultimate humility. I can do these things that nobody else can do. And you know what I'm going to do with that? I'm going to share it with you. That's what I call humility. There's another little part of humility. How do you deal with rejection? You know, if you're rejected, pick your venue. Class election. You didn't get elected secretary of the class this time. Hey, it's rejection. We don't like rejection. Inside, we don't like that. That's not... We want to be loved. So, what are the options? Well, we can get real angry. We can fight back. If you look through the black verses, every time Jesus was rejected, He left. He just went away. He told that to His followers. He said, "Shake off the dust of your sandals and just go." He didn't exactly say, "Wait till next year and they have the election again, maybe you'll get elected." He didn't exactly say that. He didn't say, "Stay in the synagogue, don't leave it, and you'll see how things work out." He didn't say that. He said, "Just go." He went on and He did other work. So, we'll get to the application, but keep that in the back of your mind. What we're bringing up again is another issue of balance, isn't it? Balance. Do you leave? Do you stay? How did Jesus come to the right conclusion on each one of those incidents? All right, let's move on. The next thing is that He protected His own quiet time. He did have limits. And the scriptures tell us, Matthew 14, that he dismissed the crowd. So there were times, didn't happen a lot, apparently, but there were times when he said, okay, folks, we've had enough for today. I'm going to go do something else. So I thought part of his walk was that he protected his own quiet time. There was a touch of assertiveness. There was a touch of self-control. And I think that was a good thing. The next item is he was unencumbered. You could see from his daily life that he didn't have any of the earthly trappings that slow us down. He didn't have a house. He didn't have a family. Somebody asked him where he lived. And I think it was kind of a little bit of a humorous thing. And he said in Matthew 8, he says, you know, foxes have holes, birds have nests, but I actually don't have anywhere that I live. He was unencumbered. The next item is that he was a great teacher. Well, that's one we've known all along, isn't it? He was the greatest teacher. But maybe we should say, what kind of teacher was he? Well, I have my opinions. My opinion is that his specialty was simplicity. He had a skill like no other teacher in making things understandable and simple. You know, Einstein said something like, if you can't explain something briefly and simply, you don't understand it. And if it takes you forever to explain something, I'm going to quote Brother Einstein and say, you don't understand it very well. So his stories were simple. Read the Sermon on the Mount. They are simple concepts. And notice that his greatest sermon was not on the steps of the temple, was not in some famous synagogue in Caesarea or something like that. It was out in the mountain. It was out in the fields. Simple. He used a lot of stories. He used analogies. I love it. I guess I'm simple-minded. So it works for me. I think the thought comes up that one of his best followers was John, young John. Well, later on, when John grew up, he became a little bit of a mystic, and he wrote some letters. He wrote the book of Revelation. Oh, my goodness, the book of Revelation. It's got dragons in it. It's got animals with multiple heads. It's got a head of one animal, body of another animal. It just goes, he pours out poisons on the water. The water turns to blood. There's lightning. There's flashes. There's explosions. This is John. Revelation. Jesus didn't talk like that. Simple. Next item is that Jesus was very forthright. And he was direct. And especially, we're familiar with the interactions he had with the scribes and the Pharisees. And he would point out to them. And he used some pretty strong language. You know, he called them hypocrites. I don't know if the word had quite the jab that it has today, because in Greek that word means actor. So, you know, he said, you Pharisees, you're a bunch of actors. Well, that doesn't sound quite as bad, does it? As if I said, you guys in the back row there, you're all hypocrites. Well, that's really bad. So I'm not sure about that. But he did not, so to speak, pull any punches. And when his disciples were off talking about who was going to be in charge and who was the greatest, he called them on it. He was forthright. He said, what were you guys talking about when we were coming here? And I think one of the greatest challenges that he had in his ministry was getting the Jews to understand that God's plan was for everybody. You know, the Jews were the chosen people, and they believed that, to the exclusion of everybody else in the world. And so somehow Jesus had to get across to them that, you know, Abraham's blessing is to all the families of the earth. So if I were Jesus' press secretary, or diplomacy advisor, consultant, I would have said, Jesus, don't bring up that Gentile thing at the beginning of your ministry. You're going to lose a lot of people. Save it for after you get their confidence. And there's a parallel to that. Sometimes when we think we want to witness to some Jewish people. They say, well, don't mention Jesus right off. Keep that quiet. Just bring up the Old Testament prophecies. Get them kind of stirred up and you know, just kind of go that way. I think that's a big mistake. I mean, I think Jesus has got to be there right at the beginning. But anyway, back to this Jesus, his forthrightness. What's he do with this Gentile subject? Bam! It's the first thing almost out of his mouth. In the fourth chapter of Luke, which is the beginning of his ministry, he's talking about the Phoenician woman, he's talking about Naaman the Syrian. And what was the response? The people were furious and they literally took him and tried to kill him. This is the beginning of his ministry. What a start. Forthright. Okay. The eighth item is that he set his own standards. The standards of other people meant nothing to him. The Pharisees said the traditions of the elders meant nothing to him. He lived by the scriptures and his understanding of God's Holy Spirit. He was really into the spirit of the law. He didn't listen to what other men said. He didn't mind breaking traditions. He didn't mind breaking church rules. But he had a balance. He knew when to say things and when to be quiet. And we notice that there's a progression and a change. And in the last couple weeks of his life, he changed. He didn't just take off when they confronted him. He stood there because he knew that he was supposed to die. So he became silent. Those are the eight elements that popped out to me. So I'd now like to talk about those elements and us walking his walk. I'll start with discrimination. That's what we had first. I suspect we all have pockets of discrimination. We react to something almost emotionally. I walk into a Walgreens and I see the lady there with her Middle Eastern headdress on and she's wearing a robe and a gown. You know, what I was used to was a kid in a t-shirt and jeans behind the counter. And I see this woman in her outfit and I react inside and I slap myself. Can't do that. So if there's in any sense someone of a different religion, a different view, a different class, a different ecclesia, we have to practice now. Because what do you think the work in the kingdom is? We're going to be working with people who have been discriminated against. We're not going to work for that 1% of the 1% who had everything they ever wanted. The work of the kingdom is with the discriminated. So whether they're handicapped, they're disfigured, that we would shun away from. Whether they're impaired, sometimes these are our brethren, psychologically impaired. Practice a little bit, the kingdom work, practice it now. Humility. You know, I kind of think the number one need of humanity is that need for getting credit. You know, we crave that so much, I think, I do. And we want approval. Jesus' walk was so opposite. And especially those who have made mistakes. We have brethren who have made some serious mistakes. The bigger the mistake, the more help they need. And I love the part how Jesus shared his abilities. I'm just blown away by the fact that he let the disciples cast out demons and raise the dead. I don't know if they had the faith to do it, because in some cases they failed. But he gave that to them. And I suspect that we don't have enough of an appreciation for the abilities that Jehovah and his son have given us. I don't think we reach out enough. I don't think we take enough risks on doing things. You notice that Jesus didn't talk about himself and you don't see a lot of use of the word I. Now that's a danger symbol. Someone's always talking about I this and I that. That's not so good. And I'm not sure, I brought up under humility that Jesus left. When he had a problem, he left. I'm not saying that that's what you should do. Because there's a whole set of differences between Jesus and us. Okay. He was perfect. He had that balance. He had that judgment. He had that intuition. We don't have that. Not quite. But just keep some of these principles in mind of his walk. He didn't argue with people. He kind of just left. Now the next one I'm going to bring up is how forthright Jesus was. How he called out the hypocrites and on this one, my advice here is to go easy. Okay? I am not recommending that you go start cleaning out temples and turning over tables and have a little thing in your hand that you can get the sheep out of the temple and the goats and stuff like that. Again, we don't have the judgment, we don't have the insight, we don't have the intuition, we don't have the degree of the spirit that our master had. So I'm going to say we go easy on this one. But I, at the same time, I would say, don't stop your brain from working. Don't stop your analysis that behavior is hypocrisy, or that behavior is acting. But I'm kind of recommending that we don't take a lot of action on it, and we turn the lesson to ourselves. And one of the things that Jesus had no fear of in his forthrightness was preaching a message that was not popular. Don't be afraid of delivering a message that's not popular. Jesus was a great teacher. What can we learn from that? The first thing we need to learn from Jesus was a great teacher is that we need to be great students. Okay? Second lesson is a little bit more for our leaders and our teachers. And I'm saying, don't strive to be politically correct. Give us lessons that change our lives. Give us lessons that we can do something with tomorrow. When we come to the Sunday meeting, don't let it just be, oh, that was an interesting discussion. Yeah, it was a lot of speculation. That's how it was interesting. Give us something we can do on Monday morning that we're walking the walk a little bit better. The next one is setting our own standards. Well, I'm a big fan of being your own self. Be yourself. Don't try to be somebody else. But keep in mind that Jesus was all about the spirit of the law. You don't have to follow somebody else, but pick up the spirit of the law. Don't be afraid to break traditions. But understand the times and seasons. What's appropriate now? What's appropriate later? Be moved by the Spirit. Now, how do you gain this balance and this wisdom? Well, I think it's the next two items. And the next one on in this order is that you be unencumbered as possible. The more stuff you have, the more problems you're going to have making decisions. The stuff can be your job. The stuff can be possessions. The stuff can be obligations. There's some things that have to be cut off. It could be even family. You notice that Jesus cut off his natural family, and he said, my family are those who do the will of the Father. And the other part of this learning how to do balance is that Jesus protected his quiet time. If you don't have those two things, to the degree that, well, let's say it this way, to the degree that you are encumbered, and you've got a lot of stuff, and you don't have any quiet time, you're going to make lousy decisions. I'll tell you that. You have to have time to think these things through. You have to have time to set your own standards. It takes time to be a good student or a good teacher. It takes time to know when to be forthright and when to be quiet. You got to think these things through. You have to be under control. There's no room for impulsiveness. You don't see Jesus doing impulsive things. He wasn't like his 12 friends. Unencumbered and protect your quiet time. The last one, number 8, as I reordered this list, is service. If you don't know what to do with your life, and you're not sure what to do next with your consecrated path, your walk, then serve. Serve. I think that's what Jesus did. I think that was the majority of his life. I came not to be served, but to serve. His service knew no bounds. Let our service know no bounds. Let me summarize, bring this to a conclusion. The essence of walking the walk is that whatever you profess to be, if you profess to be a Christian, then make sure you're a Christian. If you profess to be a Bible student, then make sure that you're a Bible student. If any of the things that I've brought up out of the black writings, the black letters of the Gospels were a shock to you, you say, well, I don't know about that, then I'm going to say both of us need to read the Gospels more. We've got to have those stories virtually memorized. We've got 4 presentations of our Lord's life. We've got to know that like the back of our hand. You know, I'm so guilty in this because I feel bad at work. I'm an expert at work, okay? I got a little chocolate shop. I can tell you stuff about chocolate that I could put you to sleep. And You know, do I have that same expertise on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? I'm not so sure, but that's my goal. So it's a huge mistake to think that when we study technicalities and we study speculations and we are making up numbers and we're making up dates as to when this is all going to be over, it's a huge mistake to think that when we do that, we are walking the walk that Jesus walked. That's not what Jesus did. Read it. It's all there. I was going to say, it's all there in black and white. It's not black and white. It's black and red. So I think we do pretty well as a group. I do. I think our walk is good. Can our walk be better? I think so. So my encouragement to you is to tackle this subject. Make this figuring out what the walk is, make that your assignment. I got the assignment for this weekend. Thank you so much for giving me this assignment. I don't know if you knew how much I needed this. I've learned so much. I needed to learn this. And I kind of think it changed me a bit. And I'm kind of hoping I'll never be the same. So God bless you as you redouble your efforts to walk Jesus' walk. Thank you.